Okay, we're back with part two with George Vesey. You just missed a great story, but we're going to leave that one off the air. But we're here with for part two for our question and answers. Sir, would you like to lead off right in the middle?
I thought one of the enlightening parts of the book was the relationship he had with his family, specifically his father.
Yeah.
His father is, and didn't really understand. And there was, it almost was like, it seemed like Stan, he almost, I don't know, it's almost like he spun his life to make his father appreciate him.
Right.
And, you know, his father came around and went to games when the Cards had come through Pittsburgh and whatnot. But I'd love to hear, you know, some thoughts of yours about what you learned from
Sure.
that.
Sure. I thought it was very touching, and you're right. There is a chapter where a photographer who was with Stan in Forbes Field near the end of his career, Musial told an anecdote about how his dad took him into the bleachers in Forbes Field or the outfield and in Forbes Field. And it's such a nice story, but probably not true, that there's no record of the father ever taking his son up. There was just, the father was an immigrant from Poland, never really got comfortable with the language, and bluntly speaking, had a bit of a drinking problem. So, which came up in the signing that the father didn't want the boy to sign. Musial has told the story that my dad wanted me to go to college. It probably is the other way around, that the father wanted him to work in the zinc mill and get a salary and play ball on the weekends. People around who knew the family, one old lady I knew who'd known Musial when he was a boy, you know, I've lost track of her, but she, you know, she was in her 90s when I met her 5-6 years ago. She told the story. So Musial was spinning it, I think, in a thoroughly, and probably believes it. I mean, probably by now, I don't think he would stop and, you know, or you know, 20 years ago, he would stop and say, that's not the way it happened. But in the way it evolved with him, I think he probably wanted, and yet he was not that close to his father. There were a few years when he was playing in the minor leagues when according to a lot of people, they didn't speak. You know, he was off playing baseball, and he was making less money than he would at the Denora zinc mills. So the father didn't think that was a very good career choice. But the other side of it was how Musial sought out men as his mentors, and they sought him out. I mean, it's a world of people who want to do favors for other people. I mean, I grew up watching my dad help people get jobs in the newspaper business. That's just what you do. I've done a bit of it myself. You know, we're all trying to pass something on to the next generation. And Musial found all kinds of a car dealer in Pittsburgh who taught him not only how to dress, but how to look people in the eye, how to shake hands, how to succeed in business. The fact that Musial became a businessman, you know, not just a ball player trading on his name, but a guy who could go into his own meat locker and know a good steak from an ordinary steak, it was important to him. And he got that from this guy back in Denora named Frank Pitsica, who had taught him to be a good businessman, to care about what you're doing. Don't just sell cars, but look people in the eye and sell them a good car. And that was the look for a mentor. Fortunately, it worked out for him all along the line. He met a dozen guys who helped him along in the business. So it's touching in a way. The only thing that saves it from being more touching is that Musial never went near it emotionally, as far as I can see, never talked about it. As Jerry, his daughter, would say, you know, Dad doesn't do those kinds of things. Dad doesn't do introspection. He doesn't talk about himself. He never talked about his childhood. And when his good buddy Bob Brague tried to do, was working on the autobiography, you know, my story as told by Stan Musial, as told to Bob Brague, Stanley would roll by the house that he grew up in, wouldn't even stop and knock on the door and ask himself in, which, you know, Pee Wee Reese did that back in Bay Ridge, knocked on a door and said, you know, my name is Harold Reese, I used to live here, and then of course you did, come on in. But Musial wouldn't do that. He wouldn't even slow down, or just, you know, barely slow down and say, there's the house I lived in, and kept rolling. It was just too painful to him. There were a lot of painful things. It was not an idyllic childhood. Question, please.
Yeah. There is another book written relatively recently about Musial, and a lot of it seemed to be a lot of glad handling about Musial. The primary focus of the book seems to be how massively high Musial was, and you mentioned that earlier in your talk. How does your book kind of add to the knowledge base about Musial? Being that there's been a lot written about him, you know, up to this point. What new insights did you find during the course of your research? And
In a way, I think it confirmed. I mean, I certainly. It's layers. And when I went and found older people, are you talking about the Wayne Stewart book? Wayne Stewart grew up in Denora, and he's a writer. I believe he lives in Cleveland now. It's a pretty good book. I mean, he had access to some of the old timers in Denora that I didn't get to. So there were a lot of people who knew Musial when they were the same age. You know, now they're 90 or they're 80. I think he had an advantage in that respect. But if you're asking me what knowledge I had, I want to confirm or deny a lot of the things that people believed in him. I don't think I came up with anything earth-shattering. I mean, you know, Angie Dickinson would be the off the charts kind of thing. You know. Did I want to know it at all? And since it didn't happen, I didn't. But there were other things about what kind of guy he was. Nothing was far from the mold. I mean, I was a little surprised. I guess you're always surprised. You think at some point there'll be a Rosebud situation. But first of all, because he was not available, but nobody around him. He doesn't come from a whole cluster of introspective, chatty New York types. Who look deeply into, 17 layers of things. In a lot of cases, it was, this is the way it was, this is how it happened. So I don't want to downgrade what I did, but because I did a lot of research, but I would say the guy I thought was there was the person that was there. But in some cases, it's great to get a story about what really happened. Stories I didn't know existed. I mean, you get Dick Thornburg talking about a party in the Vatican when Musial was there doing his terrible magic tricks. I mean, it's the filling out of it. It's the thing you didn't know because nobody had thought. But, and by the way, there was also another book that was written 15 years ago, partially as the reason why I didn't get any cooperation from the Musial family. A guy named James Giglio, who's a professor in whatever it's called now, Southwest Missouri State College, did a very well-researched book. And for example, I didn't come up with this, but Giglio found out that Stan and Lil Musial were married in a church in May or June of 1940. And they said they'd gotten married on Stan's birthday in November of 1939. There's no evidence of that. There's no wedding certificate. But she was 7 months pregnant when they got married. And Dickie Kerr, the great baseball player, everybody knows that Dickie Kerr took them into the house, which is why their oldest child is named Richard S. Musial. But Giglio was such a good reporter that he went down and found the wedding certificate and the story in the Denora paper about this boy getting married, young player getting married in the middle of the baseball season. Didn't mention his wife was pregnant, but she had the baby. Irrelevant, except that Giglio was a good researcher and reporter, and had done a lot of the dirty work that I give him credit for. And every time I talk about the book, I say that there was a guy I respect a lot who did a lot of the reporting, and I, grabbed onto the back of that car and wrote. And I make them. It's called research. It's called giving credit to people. But I didn't come up with some of that original research. And I heard from Giglio just today. Something I'd said, and I wanted to send it back to him to let him know that he was in my. I think about him all the time for having done a nice book. But the Musial family, as you can imagine, hated the book and other things. There were a couple of things that Lil had said when, she just had the baby and she wasn't too happy about his career and she wanted to go back home and work in the family store. And he didn't put it in the book, but he had it in a historical article that he had done back in, the mid-90s. And the Musial family just wanted nothing to do with him. As a result, Musial cut off some of his friends who had cooperated with that book. And even when he was out and about, he was not cooperating with writers who came in over the transom. So I I think that somebody else did some of the original reporting for parts of it, but believe me, it's footnoted well in there, and I give him full credit for it. Questions, please.
George, excuse me. Initially, you said that somebody approached you with the publishers about doing a book on band music.
Right.
And this is just like a general question because I'm not really familiar with your business. At some point, and then you said you contacted the family, but they weren't going to, they let it be known they weren't going to help you or however
right.
you want to.
Right.
Do you have to get permission to do a biography on
no.
me?
No, in fact, I'm going to work on it.
Could they take legal action to stop you if they didn't
want
anything?
No, he's in the public eye. Anybody who's got a website called Stan the Man Inc., which is how I started. I mean, I had inquired about the best way, and a couple of people said, let me check. I hadn't been in touch with my friend Willie yet, so that was not the contact, but I did, through a couple of people, said, let me check and see if the family's interested, and the word got back. But then I dialed the 1-800 number for Stan the Man, and I got Zitzman, and I said, I'm looking for the person who handles all of Stan's interviews and so on. And Zitzman says, well, I'm the guy. And he's a businessman, very nice, very presentable. But he let me know very quickly that Stan would not be available. He didn't exactly explain why, but, you know, a couple of guys I know in baseball had told me what the deal was. But no, the Musial does not, I don't need anything. For somebody, a totally private person, to write about them, there's a sort of invasion of privacy at some point, but not for somebody who's been out in public as much as Musial.
So that's a big factor. Then he had a website, he's got a career, he's been every encyclopedia.
Yeah, but the reality is, if somebody's been in the news for, they're anonymous people that get books written about them. If they're of interest, it's very hard to prove, as I understand it. I'm not a lawyer, a libel lawyer or anything, but. Invasion of privacy is very hard to prove, even for people with relatively private lives, because if you can prove that there's something of interest about them that is not that ought to know or could be known, our lives are all out there anyway. I mean, goodness knows. But anyway, in Musial's case, there was not an issue.
You can't quote from letters.
I can't quote from letters?
No, because those are copyrighted. That was the J.D. Salinger thing. When somebody tried to write a biography of J.D. Salinger, they could only paraphrase. They couldn't quote the letters.
Huh. The good news is that Stanley didn't write no letters. Question, please. Yeah.
Military service, was Stan's career interrupted? I don't know his history that well.
A good question. He served in 1945. It was the only season he missed, as opposed to Williams, Bob Feller, and even DiMaggio missed, I think, 3 years. And I cover that in the book. I prorated what those guys would have done at their peak. They're all at their peak. Can you imagine the number of wins and strikeouts that Feller would have had if he hadn't insisted on not only going to war, but being on a ship and doing the fighting?
Wasn't he the first major leaguer to volunteer?
I don't think so. I don't think Feller was. Greenberg
drafted in 41.
But Greenberg had been drafted already. He was already in the service.
Feller
volunteered quickly. I don't think he was the first, but people were signing up. I think he was probably registered. I think the draft had come in 39 or 40 because Greenberg had been in. But Feller had insisted. I mean, he went right in and said, here I am, get me, and so on. Musial registered for the draft when he had to. He registered out of Denora, which had a huge surplus of young males, single young males. By 1941, he had a son, father and a mother who were not well. The father had already retired from work in the zinc mill. So he had a full family. And by the rules of whatever the number was, you know, 2F, 3A, whatever it was, he was exempt for a long time. I went to the papers in Denora, in Pittsburgh, and in St. Louis, a great library out by the university in St. Louis, one of the universities. And there's not a story that ever raises the question of citizens saying, now, people in St. Louis, and by the way, my debt to St. Louis, my book sold so well in St. Louis. I have a huge debt to that city. Even now, I heard from the big interviewer there, the big talk show, that the book is like the head of the Christmas list and all that. But people in St. Louis have this theory, and one of the major themes of the book, and I've hardly gotten into it tonight, is that people in St. Louis feel that Musial is underappreciated because he played in St. Louis. It's the flyover theory. Look at us. We used to be a top 10 city. We're not anymore. East Coast, West Coast, people look down on us. It's a whole litany of complaints. They have a point. But as I said to these lovely people in St. Louis, look at DiMaggio and look at Williams. Both of them got goaded by the public, by the press, and by their own ownership. In DiMaggio's case, DiMaggio was asking for more money. I forget how it worked, 42 or 4, whatever the year was. And the owners went to the writers and said, this Italian boy, he wants a lot of money, and we're not even sure, you know, what kind of citizen is he? Why isn't he in the army? And so the writers are all writing this stuff about what kind of patriot is DiMaggio. So as I told the people in St. Louis, Williams was the sole support of his mother by that time. His brother was in jail. His father was a ne'er-do-well. He was taking care of his family and had every right to be exempt. But he was hounded by many of the fans, not Colonel Dave Egan, who was his big nemesis. Egan said, everybody leave him alone on this one. He has a right to go in when he goes in. But Musial had none of that in St. Louis or Pittsburgh area, that they took it at face value. When he went in, he went in. He wound up playing baseball in Pearl Harbor in a baseball league that a lot of other major leaguers played in. Dan Topping, the owner of the Yankees, was the commissioner of it. If you can imagine, you know, rich guys get to be commissioners even in wartime. And Musial, who'd been a pretty much of a defensive slap hitter when he came up, the admiral said to him, "Hey, you're a major leaguer. Hit home runs." Yeah. So, yes, sir, he started to hit home runs. When he came back in 46, he had a little bit better power stroke. Then Kiner was getting paid more money than he was for hitting home runs. And then Musial started to hit home runs in 47 because he wanted to make money and support himself. But the answer is, there was no pressure on him. It's one of the bonuses of living in the flyby city. Question, please.
George, you kind of just briefly talked about the trauma of his childhood a couple of questions ago. And you handled the history of Denora really well, the fact that it affected his father's health. Obviously, that's a Rust Belt casualty that's happening now.
Right.
But you really were very delicate, it seemed to me, in the book, in dealing with what I guess you could call the childhood poverty of the family. Looking back on it now, if you thought about it, could you have written more about their economic circumstances?
You know, probably. I mean, the fact that you got that out of it would tell me that I touched the base. There's probably more available. I'm off the top of my head, even in stuff that was written. I mean, the people that were there, his mother's long gone, people didn't talk about stuff like that. If knowing my eye and ear for detail, I'd like to think that if anybody had told me, I mean, I do know that they lived off, root food, you know, cabbages and potatoes. They put them down in the cold basement with the coal and stuff like that. And I believe I mentioned, if I didn't, I mean, but they did not. I certainly have stuff in there that the mother made, the delicacies, the Polish delicacies that she learned to cook. She was Polish. She learned to cook for her husband. But I don't know that there was much more available.
Okay,
I don't know.
Let me follow up that and say, if there were more, do you wish there were more?
Well, I'm a writer. I mean, I always wish there were more. You know, I want Angie Dickinson to tell me we had a fling. I want Sally Hemis to say I couldn't stand the guy and that's why I benched him. You know, I want Joe Garagiola. I want to call my friend Joe Garagiola and him to say that crook. You know, and his son and that other guy, and they're all crook. You know, and Joe true is code. But the point is, that's what we do all the time. And I think there was enough of it. If you got the point, then I did my job. I don't think I had any more. I mean, what they ate on a typical day, Musial, as Jerry says, or his daughter says, my dad doesn't go there. I mean, he doesn't go back, and he never talked to his kids. I mean, I bore the hell out of my kids telling them about how, you know, the Chef Boyardee spaghetti that my mom would, you know, she had a big family, and she'd be dumping the spaghetti. And we, some of us talk a lot, and others don't. I don't think that's a talking part of the world. Although other people, I mean, it's not just Musial, but, God, I'm blanking on his name, the lawyer from Milwaukee who played basketball for Marquette in the book, the black guy, he's talking about A, being African-American in Denora, but he's talking about the House of Ill Repute down by the coal down by the zinc mill, and he's talking about washing cars and the dirt. I mean, that would, to me, was like real deep. Now, he's younger, but I love details like that. I mean, if a guy's going to tell me about what he always thought was a hotel, it turns out wasn't exactly a hotel, and here he is, this 15-year-old kid, washing cars and looking at all the guys going in there, wondering what's going on there. That's the kind of detail that writers love. Writers don't not use their good material. You know, if there'd been material available on hardtack and gruel that Musial was served by his mom, you know, the pasty little thing, you know, dough or something for breakfast, I would have used that because that's what we do. But I think that's the most I had, and you know. What you see is what was there. Questions, please. Yeah.
How important do you think it is that current ball players understand the history of guys like Stan or other players of that era? I feel like there's been there's somewhat of a disconnect between baseball in the past 15 years and what it was.
Can I quote Vince Coleman? No, Jackie Robinson, man. I mean, you know, he probably did know Jackie Robinson, but the point was that the ball players are not historians. Some of them are educated, some of them, but their lives are pretty complicated, and history gets more. Ball players know what they need to know, and there's so much stuff out there. I mean, they're busy twittering away their own deep inner feelings, as we all are. And they're very poised. They know how to go on television. They're smart enough to know how to get in, you know, to make public appearances and to handle themselves out. It's a more complicated world. So in the days when it's just a different world. I mean, when Musial was breaking in, the players had no idea who he was. The Cardinals didn't know who he was. He came up, played a few games. There was no internet. There was no. I've gone back and looked at the lack of stories on who is this kid. Comes up at the end of the 41 season. They bring him about 12 games to go. Some of their players have been hurt. They bring a kid up from Rochester. Wasn't even their top. He comes in and he plays like a dream. Runs the bases. Doesn't have a great arm. Plays the outfield well. Steals a run by just keeping going. You know, Gas House Gang wins a game by. On the train out of St. Louis heading to Pittsburgh or Chicago, Terry Moore, one of the old-fashioned captains, like Pee Wee Reese, and you know, you don't have captains like that anymore. Guys don't sit around and talk baseball the same way. Terry Moore sitting in the parlor car or the car on the train, and he says to him, "Kid, who are you?" In a sense, like, "Where'd you come from?" He said, "Mr. Moore, don't you remember me? I'm the guy that Mr. Mize and Mr. Marion hit the home runs off when I was pitching in spring training this year." And Terry Moore said, "Hey guys, this is that rag arm lefty that we hit back in Macon, Georgia, you know, in March." The point is, the players, they didn't have the books, they didn't know stuff then, so I can't expect players today. Yeah, the information is out there, but that doesn't mean that the ball player is going to go in and find. I can find baseball reference online if I want to find an obscure player. Looking up my friend Brant Allier the other day, guy I went to Hofstra with, and I'm looking up his, you know, life and time, what Brant did, go backwards. But the ball players aren't doing it. They got other things to do. They, you know, first of all, playing the game, it's some of them, and some of them are, you know, they've got very full lives. They read, they think, they walk out. So would I like them to know about Musial? Look, in the voting, fans don't know. Musial didn't get a, this is one of the major themes of the book. I don't have a chance to, but one of the major themes is the underappreciation of, in 1999, when Musial finished out of the top 25 in the poll in the computer voting. But fortunately, baseball had provided for five other spots that would be selected by a committee, so Musial was chosen on. That's Bud Selig at the start of the book. He's groaning that Musial didn't get chosen in on. But fans don't necessarily know that. I mean, history recedes back. There's so much more history to know. When Musial was playing, look, I was a kid in the 40s, late 40s, and there are guys that are so real to me, guys that I can remember from baseball cards or whatever. And I could swear that they played for 7 years. And you look it up, and they played 43 games 1 year and 55 the next year, and they were gone. But in those 2 years, I was such a Red Hot fan that I knew the name. I could go, you know, I could see how they look like on a baseball card. The world's gotten so much more complicated. So it's a long answer, but I don't blame athletes for not. They do know a lot. They're much more sophisticated and knowledgeable than back in the day. Please.
Just an opinion on that. My opinion as to why Stan Musial today is really lost and forgotten amongst even diehard fans, especially ones who did not see him grow up. You don't see much video. I mean, Stan Musial did not have a signature moment. He did not catch a ball running back in a World Series over his shoulder. He did not hit 400. He did not have four perfect games and seven no-hitters. He was just consistently great throughout his career, and I think that just gets lost with today's fan. It's nice to see around the room, you know, an older gentleman perhaps may have seen Stan play or know more about him. But just a true story, I brought the Lego thing in. I went to my UPS guy today, and he looked at me and goes, "Who is that?" I said, "Stan Musial." "Who?" And this is a 35, 36-year-old man who likes baseball who had never heard of Stan the Man. And it sort of hurts because I'm waiting. Unfortunately, today is going to come when you're going to turn the ESPN and Stan's going to die. And it's going to be very interesting to see what they show as the highlight from his career. And besides hitting five homers and a doubleheader, that was his day.
He won the
which actually I was very surprised to see that one. I think the guys in St. Louis must have stuffed the ballot box, but MLB held what was the signature moment in the All-Star game, and it was Musial winning, I think, the 51 All-Star game in Milwaukee or whatever, or 55. Wow. But other than that, there's no big moment for Stan. I mean, he played very early in his career in a World Series, and at 46 he was finished. I mean, he didn't. That was it for postseason for Stan. I mean, 17, 18 more years, and there was nothing there.
Ask him who won the games, as Luke said.
Yeah, and they did. They never had pitching.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. And he also, as a decent family man, not a spectacular, headline guy, and the East Coast, you can't underestimate the furor, the excitement that Williams and DiMaggio touched off. In those same years, they were different personalities. And I think the personalities has as much to do with it as the fact they played in Boston or New York. But he just didn't excite people in quite the same way, a great player. But there is so much more history going backwards. You know, as we hurtle forward into the future, there's just so much. Look, when I was a kid, I would hear about Hannes Wagner or Pye Trainer, or guys who played for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 30s were ancient history to me. I didn't care. So I think that we all, the world belongs going forward, and Pujols is the one we talk about. It's, you can compare him to Musial, but that's the guy that's playing Ryan Braun. We're involved in him. What's going to, and it is, life does go on. So I can see where people do get put by the wayside by history. It's unfortunate, but certain people stay on for that, the basket catch, the whatever it was they did. Please.
George, I think we're leaving out the introduction of the agents. These guys that we're thinking about years ago had to negotiate for themselves. The agents today are going to blow them up and to make them all Babe Ruths.
Well, all of that's true, except that history takes care of that. I mean, what players make is a whole other subject, but the numbers and how the players perform, You know, Scott Boras can give you a book this big, but ultimately the fans will know if a guy has two good years or 17 great ones. It's a different time. Anybody hasn't asked a question yet? Yeah, please.
Could he have hung on one more year? They won the World Series the next year. Mattingly left a year early in retrospect. And had he retired a year later, he would have been a World Champion.
Musial was 42, and he hadn't been playing regularly. He had some good hitting years, but they'd been subbing him out. And even after he came through his Trader Lane and Sally Hemus years when they were trying to downgrade him, he did come back and play more, but it was more as an icon, playing 120 games a year and being taken. Could he play another year? You know his line on it. When they won the World Series in 60, I was there in 64. I was a kid reporter for Newsday. And people come up and say, Stan, how do you feel about the Cardinals winning the World Series? You know who they brought in to play left field. You know, Lou Brock. So Musial would go around town with that giggle, and he'd say, hey, we finally got a good left fielder. So that was the point. Musial had a good line about it, and what could he say? They brought in Looper. They traded a fading pitcher, one of the great trades of all time. And Musial was wise enough to know, don't grouse about it. And the same way Mattingly did. You know, Mattingly retired, and the next year they win it all. But class act, and also Mattingly had a bad back and wanted to be home for family reasons.
Right.
I think classy guys like Mattingly and Musial, when confronted by it, then there are people that lament and say, why, I could have hung around, or I could have. The fact is, hanging on isn't a good thing either. So I say that myself. I mean, anybody who gets to a point, you say to yourself, do I want to be Willie Mays stumbling around at second base? No, the money's good and the life is good, and it's fun to be part of the team, but at some point, when is enough enough? And in Musial's case, it was probably the right time to do it. Question, please. Anybody has? Yeah, please.
Who do you think is the best subject out there right now for the next book? A letter that perhaps people don't appreciate the way they should.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm so burned out from having done this one. I haven't thought about it. I don't know. Well, who do you think? Yeah, what do you think? You have any?
I don't know. I think about the players that I don't know a lot about,
yeah,
that I probably should know more about.
I think there probably is. But good book. There's always another. There's always a good book waiting to be done, and it doesn't necessarily have to be about somebody who hasn't had one done. It can be a different view of that person, but. The books that get me are the ones that come in over the transom that you haven't expected. But no, at this point, I don't. Yes, sir.
One of the things I think also that Musial had to compete with is the Gashouse gang before him, which became sort of a. This is a group. In fact, you probably know that in the cemetery in the Bronx, Frankie Frisch has at his tombstone all the players at their slots. Dizzy Dean as a pitcher and the whole team, that whole Gashouse team.
On his tombstone?
Yeah, no, it's around the grave. Every Cardinal player at the Gashouse.
Which cemetery is that?
Woodlawn Cemetery.
Didn't know that.
And it's a very, very interesting thing. And here you got a whole group. Every one of them was well known.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
So,
that's a trip. I've been talking about going to Greenwood, but I have to go to Woodlawn too.
Yeah, but Musial really didn't stand. I mean, he was one player, but the Cardinals weren't as consistently great as they were when the Yes House gang was there.
Yeah, they won four pennants in 5 years when he came up, but.
Yeah.
It, there was also the image of the
43 and
yeah. There was also the image of the it was four and
42
and then 46
and
44. There was the image of the Gashouse gang. I mean, your point is well taken that was a rollicking bunch from a different time. I mean, the 30s were a more uninhibited time than the 40s. People got more sophisticated, and Musial was a different personality. I mean, he did play music. I forget he learned to play the harmonica. But when he first came up, he and a couple of other guys would be banging wire hangers, and you know, they had this whole jug band that they would play. But
Dizzy Dean himself was enough to keep a whole
exactly.
country.
No, it's a different. It was a different personality. The level of education and sophistication rises. I mean, Musial is a high school graduate, but he was more of a button down guy than the generation before him. Questions, please. Yes, please.
With Pujols signing with Anaheim, the Angels, do you think that elevates, like, if not saying that Musial status needs to be elevated, but that like further elevates his status as like the number one Cardinal?
Well, two things. First of all, I think that Musial, as the number one Cardinal, this probably ices it for the next half century, because no matter what Pujols does for himself or for his team, and he could give them good value for 5, 6, 7 out of those 10 years, but Musial is going to be the man who stayed. And in St. Louis, two guys who play for two, I mean, unless you're a Reggie Jackson that just, you know, kind of stirs it up wherever you go, Pujols had to know that. I gave him a lot of gratuitous advice in a column in October saying that he's a guy that might not do well in big cities because he's not the most outgoing person. But whatever the reason, the money, whatever, he chose to leave. And I do think it points out, Pujols is 30. I was around him during the World Series. He didn't look like an athlete that was going to be performing at top level at 35 or 38. He's gotten heavy. Things were hurting him. He didn't move well. He was kind of, I mean, he's still a great hand to eye, the 3 home runs in the game. But if I had to guess, I would say he isn't, even discounting the steroids and all the other stuff that people took, I'd have to guess that Pujols is not a guy that's going to be, you're going to look at him like I saw Bonds in that World Series in 2002. Whatever he was doing, he captivated that. I don't think Pujols is going to be at that level when he's 38 or 39. And it makes you appreciate more that Musial was still hitting over 300 for a couple of years. I think he won his last batting title at 37 or something like that, and still hitting, had a couple of good innings, and Williams. So it time does tell. I mean, the players you think are great in their 20s, when the Mattingly got hurt, time does tell. Musial did last a very long time, partially because he took good care of himself. Went off in the offseason and worked out, did his Polish Falcon exercises and all of that. So, this makes Musial el hombre for the future. Please.
A little edgy question here. What do you think about the sports writers of today? I mean the younger generation. You're talking about ball players, not
me. Me lo siento, pero no hablo. Ya me pone mayo. I don't know.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot. No,
I'm not on the spot. I could give you a whole rap, but it's a touchy subject. I mean, there are some terrific ones. Joe Posnanski's great. He's as great as anybody now or in any time. So life goes on. There's plenty of good people. I don't want to sound like a grouch. I have more of an issue with bloggers, you know, the underwear guys who aren't there, who are proud of not being there. That's more of my issue. There are a lot of good people writing whose names I know. I'd be the first to tell you I'm not keeping up with a whole lot of stuff on the internet. And newspapers have, their importance has gone downhill. So it's more to do with technology, electronics, economics. There's a lot of factors involved. When I was a young baseball writers were a big deal, and now they're all, you know, with their thumbs, nobody talks. I don't know if they can talk. So we have more fun.
Actually, I have a related, unrelated question.
Right.
You've been watching Major League Baseball for over 60 years. sorry about that. Actually, I'm jealous.
It's true.
Putting aside the money, the agents, the guys are tweeting or whatever, just the ball players. over the time that you've been watching the game, what do you think about the current game versus what it was?
You know, I can work on nostalgia, and would I love to go back? I'm not very good at going back. I don't watch a lot of television or videos or history or stuff, but I'd love to go back and be in Ebbets Field and see Dixie Walker hit a home run that he did on the first game that I saw in 1946. My dad took me in the press room, and the bartender slid a Coke across the bar. And 15 years later, I'm in Polo Grounds, and I'm talking to Louis, the bartender, and he's, yeah, I used to work in Ebbets Field. And I'm saying, were you there? And so anyway, that's a lot of but I'd love to go back and see the guys who played the Dodgers and the Reds play the first game. But athletes of today are so good, so much bigger, and even with all of La Russa's bringing in all these pitchers and the machinations and the games are too long. And the one thing I'd like to do is shoot out all the speakers in the ballpark, mm-hmm. and start. I'd start with that. My dad was a baseball, loved baseball, and he was a copy editor for a long time, and finally got out to work for the AP in his his retirement years. And he would just sit there and yell, "Turn that down!" But what really made me feel good was in 1986 that another grumpy old man was yelling, "Turn it down!" at the ballpark at Chase Stadium. It was Nelson Doubleday. Of course, he owned the damn team. So when he yelled, "Turn it down," they turned it down the next day. It was terrible for game one and two, or game one. By game two, it was down. By game six and seven, Nelson just kept saying, "Turn the damn thing down." But you have to own a team to do that. Yeah, there's a lot of changes. Baseball today, I marvel at the athletes, what they can do. They keep in great shape. Life goes on. I'll put it this way. How much do I love baseball? Okay, so we're big MSNBC fans. This will give away. I'm probably giving away all my politics. anything you couldn't have guessed anyway. But anyway, my wife and I are sitting around at night, and they're playing the Seven Dwarfs from the Republican Party, and I'm watching Sneezy and Dopey and Grumpy and Sleazy and all those guys, and I'm saying, what's the Mets score? And even what's the Yankees score? And I'm like, I'm twitching. Give me the clicker. And there's no baseball game on. It's baseball can't come back soon enough to get those gnomes out of my head. Please.
I just want to add something to what you were saying. Growing up, I recall the big difference between baseball now and then. I'm probably in your age bracket. The difference was the games were played during the day. And when there was a World Series, the teachers would let you have a radio in class so you could hear how the Dodgers or the Giants were doing, or the Yankees. And when you went home, you could hear the game. Then, of course, you could watch it on TV for a while before they all became night games. And I don't see how this current generation of kids who would have to stay up till 11, 12 o'clock at night to watch a ball game could possibly be the kind of fans that we've had for the last 40, 50 years.
Well, I can't. They play the game so late at night. I say that every October, and it's my little bleat against the world. But the reality is it's a complicated world. Baseball's making a lot of money, and they're doing okay. I mean, they must be doing okay because Pujols, as I look, just got paid a lot of money, and cable television. So it must be working out for the owners to some degree, and somebody must be caring. Somebody must be watching on TV. If it's working, the world is so much more complicated. The National Football League, in let's say our time, National Football League hardly existed. I mean, I thought of it as some cute little thing that happened, 12 Sundays in the fall, and I have to acknowledge it's a pretty big deal now. Soccer, which I love, I truly love it. It comes at a reasonable time, 2:30 in the afternoon, in the middle of the week. And I'm able to watch the best soccer in the world on cable. I mean, life goes on, but
don't you think they could lose a whole generation of fans eventually?
They are.
Yeah, but it's becoming international. It's international.
Baseball slid away.
I can't say that because baseball attendance and the interest in baseball, it's finding its niche. I mean, they know enough not to go against Monday night football or Sunday afternoon football. They know enough to move around and not. But it must be doing something. I know the ratings aren't great when you get two teams that are not less high scale, but people are going to the games in places where you have a major league team, as opposed to
buying the seats in the stadium, not kids going to the basketball.
It's a horrible scene to see the empty seats in the ballpark. All the two ballparks in New York that were built with 90s greed and 2011 reality, but they got what they deserve. If they like having those empty seats, they can live with it. I'm not a big fan of that kind of thinking, and they overpriced themselves. They should, I have some sympathy for, Wilpon and Katz to some degree, but basically people who run those, in New York, they could gouge. People are stupid, they'll pay that money, or they have the money. People pay money for everything. So it wasn't like they must have known what their market was. Now they got these empty seats. My wife, who's not a fan, the only comment she makes when I turn on a baseball game, she says, "Look at those empty seats." But it's, and she could say that every game. Please.
It reminds me of Steinbrenner when he held up New York and he said, "Who's going to watch a game in the Bronx? Only 4 million people. That's all."
Right. I mean, the number there, and when the Mets were, semi decent, they were drawing and other places that people are certainly going. And the tickets on a sliding scale, my son is buying tickets for 7 cents a ticket on eBay, and he takes his little girls way up high, and then they slip down, and he watches games at the Mets ballpark. So it'll sort itself out. But I there must be money in there; they wouldn't have been doing it.
You think they'll go back to more day baseball?
No. It's a done deal. I'm happy when there's day baseball, but I'm wise enough to know that if you've got more people who will spend more money for tickets and beer, who get out of work at 5-6 o'clock and go to the ballpark, game over. And it's inevitable. Day baseball was wonderful, but it's not coming back. Any other questions? Please.
I'd just be curious, over time, as more and more information becomes available to the average fan 24/7, were there changes that you would make in your writing approach or style over time as that started to happen?
It's a good question. I came along working for an afternoon paper. It's a concept that's laughable now. I worked for Newsday, where I could go to the ballpark. I'd be on the West Coast, and there were no agents, okay? So there was no money. You didn't have to worry about whose contract was being redone in May or something like that. So you could go to the ballpark, you could watch the game, you could go down to the clubhouse, and you can write about, at midnight, you could start to write a reasonable story because you had a couple of hours to deadline for an afternoon paper like the Post and the Good Post, the old Post, then the afternoon papers went, and now you've got 24-hour baseball to where people are blogging. I sit in the press box sometimes. I'll get in trouble for saying this. I sit in the press box sometimes, and there are people sitting next to me. I don't know who they are, and they're from my paper, and or it's not even the paper, but they're from the website. And some guy will say hello to me, and I'll see him. He's pecking away, and he's pecking away, and pecking away, and he's describing the game on the web while it's happening. I don't know that he has ever been in a dugout and heard a manager talk or asked a question or been in a clubhouse and had a ball player say, "What kind of stupid effing question is that?" Which is how you learn. I learned. Where did I learn? So you mentioned Don Mattingly before. I learned to care about, to respect the wild card in 1995, when my friend Steve Jacobson asked in the locker room, said of Don Mattingly, "But what's a wild card? If you win the wild card, what have you won? You haven't won the..." And Don Mattingly went off. "Are you crazy?" he said. We're competitive. So anyway, you learn from having ballplayers read you out on certain things. And we've got thumb guys or gnomes typing stuff, and they're writing about baseball, and I'm sure they know the statistics. I'm sure they've read, they've got all the formulas and the statistics. And one guy introduced himself to me, and I'm trying to think where it was, a Yankee Stadium. He said, late in the season, I have no idea who the guy was. I never saw him before or since. I do remember his name, But he's not anybody in our department. He's somebody that they recruited for the night to write. So people are out there on the Times website. And this isn't just the Times. It's everywhere. There are lots of... And they're not being... Yeah, trained is the wrong word, but you learn as a journalist by walking into places and having, you know, seeing things. I learned about coal mining from being at my first disaster and watching people argue and fight and, you know, be upset and widows walking around. You know, you didn't learn about it back, you know, in a press box somewhere or on a computer. So I do have concerns about that. On the other hand, we do have good baseball. We have great baseball writers at the New York Times named Tyler Kepner and Buster Olney, who was there before him. And so we have it's just different. You've got all this material going out there to satisfy the endless maw, but then you have the real reporters who are in there who do know stuff. I mean, Tyler can walk into a lobby in Dallas and he knows every general manager walking through. So your reporting is different. For me, as a columnist, my job has become much more to find the moral issue, the controversial thing. I'm not so much fussing about who wins and loses, partially because the stuff is out there on the web anyway. People have written this stuff. It's already out there. People are online. My job is to find that from the point of view from my own head, but also from still being willing to run downstairs to the clubhouse to go try. Nowadays, you don't get into a manager's office. They all sit up on this, like the Lord High Executioner. They're sitting up there on the dais, and, you know, Gerard answers a few questions, and got enough? Bam, he's gone. So you don't have a chance. I mean, 15 years ago, guys like Whitey Herzog were sitting around scratching themselves, eating their dinner, and the spaghetti's falling on their belly, and, you know, and you're like asking them, they're yelling at you and cursing at you. Bobby Cox would be sitting, and Coxie was one of the last of the people. You could go into his office and talk to him. It's a whole different world, and you don't have the access. You're not getting the open, honest emotion as much as you did, but our job is to get it, and I like to think that up until, you know, as long as I keep working, that I'll keep trying to do it differently with the expertise, and whoever these guys are, you know, pecking away, you know, sending out stuff on the web. Oh,
George, did you go to the Dallas meeting?
Did not.
No,
and I'm the last guy to hear anything. I can also tell you that.
I think just from a time factor, we're going to have
to.
We're going to have to stop the podcast. Otherwise, we're going to go over. But it's been an absolute pleasure, and as long as George Vesey keeps working and writing, we will definitely keep reading.
Well,
and it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.